thank you very much, and Steve, thank you once again. Thank you both Steve and Reem for making this series possible, and the Zeifmans for providing not only the space, but the lunch as well. I did put sign-in sheets around the table, so people could sign in. That would be great. Also, I put out flyers for our annual evening of tribute coming up June 15th. You may recall that we honored Steve last year. We are very glad to be able to offer these lunch and learns free of charge, but we are funded entirely by local donations. So if people are able to help, great. If people are not able to help, please keep coming to the programs. Okay, commercial out of the way. Our topic is indeed the overpriced contractor. I will note that next week, the third week in the set, Rabbi Ziering will be speaking on the Toronto housing bubble. So that's also something that I think people are a little bit familiar with. So I brought you an article just because I liked it. In number one, it's out of the U.S. Ex-Department of Defense contractor sentenced to 5 years in fraud scheme. A former IT consulting federal contractor received a five-year prison term from a Maryland federal judge Thursday. According to court documents, Wilkerson, who is the contractor, and Andrew Bennett, who also pled guilty, worked with a program manager at the United States Navy's Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command. That manager, James T. Shank, who also pled guilty in the scheme, would funnel contracts to Wilkerson and Bennett, who then provided employment and bonuses through markups on items like office furniture, according to court documents. Through August 2012, Wilkerson and Bennett worked with Shank to steer millions of dollars in work through labor contracts, overpriced furniture, and even entirely fake invoices, according to court documents. So the reason why I bring this, and the reason why I like it for this week, is because isn't it great what you can do to an overpriced contractor when you're the federal government? Right? You can throw them in jail for 5 years. That's the way to do it. Unfortunately, as a standard citizen, that option really doesn't come down to us. So the question is, what can individual citizens do when we want to hire a contractor? And I'll give you cases in a moment that you see them in number two. But what are our options from the perspective of Jewish law? The Torah has two protections. One is called Ona'ah, that's a biblical protection, and the other is Havka'at Sha'arim, which is a basically rabbinic protection. You talked about it a little bit last week with Rabbi Ziering as well, and I'm going to try not to have too much overlap between the two subjects, but that's the question here. And take a look at your cases in number two, and you'll see the specific examples. First example, Sarah's paving company quotes $7,000 to pave my driveway. While speaking to my neighbor that evening, I find out that the going rate is actually $5,000. Can I do anything? Or am I out of luck? Can I say to them, the going rate is $5,000? I only want you to charge $5,000. From a secular perspective, clearly the answer is no. Right? If you don't want to pay $7,000, what's your remedy? Hire somebody else, right? That's basically what you have. However, what we're going to see is that within Jewish law, there actually is a protection for the consumer to be able to say, potentially, and that's what we have to talk about, we have to talk about where this applies and where it doesn't apply, I only want to pay you $5,000 because that's the going rate. That's number one. Number two, Sarah's paving company acknowledges that the going rate is $5,000. But she's the only one in the neighborhood, and she wants $7,000. So then the question is, again, what recourse do I have? And then the third question. After my wedding, I find out that Jim's photography overcharged me. Do I have any recourse? And when I say overcharged, I don't mean that they initially said they were going to charge me X, and then they actually billed me for a different number. I mean that, again, there was a going rate, and what they charged me was too much. There's the case that we're going to see, this is a live case that this actually happened, was a photographer who had given a very cheap quote to the happy couple who were getting married. But the way they make their money is they say, if you want duplicates, we're going to bill you whatever it is, which is way above what duplicates normally cost. So they have a loss leader in terms of the initial photography charge. However, if you want duplicates, you're going to pay much more than people normally have to pay. And so they afterwards complain to the Beit Din, they complain to the court and say, this person is charging more than one should be able to charge. So those are our three questions. In our modern economy, in the capitalist society certainly, you're basically out of luck. If you want to hire them, that's your business. If you don't like what they're charging, so hire somebody else. If you don't like what anybody is charging, do the job yourself. Beginning, middle, and end. However, within Judaism, we have a concern for the other. And this really goes to an overall, overarching theme in Jewish business ethics and the guidance of appropriate behavior within Jewish law, which is to say, and we've discussed this in other contexts as well, the expectation in Judaism is that each person, each party to a deal, is going to perceive himself, herself, in a dual role. On the one hand, as an individual, responsible for myself, and on the other hand, as a citizen, responsible for the welfare of other citizens within the community. And the challenge of business ethics is to balance those two roles so that neither side is unduly harmed. So, for example, different topic altogether. When we talk about the challenge of using privileged information or using information that others do not have access to. I'm not talking about insider information which you obtain illegally. But if you have information in a deal that the other party does not have, you want to buy a piece of land and you happen to know that there's a developer who wants that piece of land and you're going to be able to flip it to the developer. Or you know that there are, you know, that you have access to a study and there's oil underground, there are minerals underground, whatever it is. Do you have any duty to let the other party know? So, from a purely secular perspective, you could argue, no, what's in his business? I spent money on this, or I have a relationship with somebody. I didn't get the information illegally. Why should he have any right to that information? On the other hand, from a Jewish business ethics perspective, you have to balance. On the one hand, yes, you can look out for yourself. On the other hand, you're a citizen, part of a community, and you're responsible to look out for the welfare of others. Without going into the inside information discussion, because that's really, you know, its own talk, that's the challenge that you're dealing with here. The balance in making an ethical calculation of, am I looking out for myself? Am I looking out for others? How can I be fair to both sides? And in the case of the contractor has to say, on the one hand, I need to be fair to myself. On the other hand, I need to look out for the community. So what are the limitations on the pricing that the contractor is allowed to set? You follow? That's the introduction, David.
How big is the community?
Very good question. Very good question. And you can make this more challenging, which we will have to. But in part, the question is, how big is the community you're asking in terms of...
Is it the people in my shul? Is it Jews? Is it Canadians? Is it...
Right. Well, to answer that piece of it, the answer is that I have obligations on all levels, just different obligations. So, for example, when the Torah presents the mitzvah of tzedakah, right, it says family first. And then local community, and then there's a possibility that Israel counts like local community, and then beyond. So we have a hierarchy of responsibilities. I should mention this here. I didn't think about it, but I didn't bring flyers for it. But on Tuesday the 23rd, I'll be participating in a program which has CLE credit for lawyers and accountants on powers of attorney. It'll be at Shari Shamayim Tuesday morning, being run through B'nai B'rith. And that's actually part of this. My role within it, my panel, is going to be discussing what happens when children are aware, or a lawyer is aware, that an adult is making decisions and doing things that are, in our assessment, to his or her detriment. And we have questions about their capacity. So what's the imperative to act? And there's a different imperative if you are a professional who works for that person, if you're the person's child, if you're the person's neighbor. So there are really, you know, there are circles of responsibility. Yeah?
Might be an interesting place to think about, which would be relevant for this, is that when somebody has, let's say, a piece of developer, a piece of land, and he's trying to maximize the amount of money he's going to make from it, without necessarily considering the impact on the people. But you may be familiar with in our neighborhood the development at Baywood and or Wilmington and Overbrook, mm-hmm. Wilmington Plaza,
yes.
Where basically the guy just wants to maximize the amount of money, and it doesn't matter who it impacts on. I just bring it up.
Right.
Not a question, but just
no, but I think that's part of that is part of this calculus. It's not necessarily where we're going today, but it's part of this calculus of looking out for yourself versus looking out for your community. That's why we have this pricing consideration. You know, in standard Western society, we like having businesses and we like the success of those businesses, and the assumption is the market will take care of correcting those who go too far. So if Sarah's paving company is going to charge $7,000 and the going rate is $5,000, she will soon find that people are going to other people for business and she's out of luck and she'll bring her price down. Right? It's the invisible hand of the market is going to take care of Sarah. But in Judaism, and keep in mind that in Talmudic times, the Roman society as well, there's a belief in the idea of limiting what people are able to do as a means of helping along the markets. Roman society did that. It was one of their ways of fighting inflation. And as we'll see, Talmudically, it's true for us as well, going back to biblical times. So let's talk about how we actually deal with this. So the issue of ona'a, and again, this was, I think, Rabbi Ziering's topic last week, so I'm just going to give a basic digest. The Torah prohibits charging somebody more than 1/6 above the going rate for a product, unless you inform the person of the specifics of what you are doing. So in other words, if the going rate for something is $100, I am allowed to charge the person $115, or I won't get reversed in the event that the person complains in court, hey, he charged me $115, right? There's some discussion about what happens between $100 and $116. I'm not going there right now. But but I can get away with charging them $115. In the event that I charge them $120, they can actually haul me into a Beit Din, into a rabbinical court, and say, this guy overcharged me, the going rate is 100. In the event that I want to charge 120, what I have to do is go to them and say explicitly, the going rate's 100, I'm going to charge you 120. So that they know very clearly what's going on, and in that case they can pay if they chose to, they knew. The operative term in terms of ona'a is deception. I cannot deceive them into paying more than the going rate. I have to let them know and be above board. That's the issue of ona'a. So the rate that a person can charge, I should note, includes not only the cost of whatever it is that's being sold. It includes other costs involved as well. So in other words, it isn't just that I can say to them that I'm buying an air conditioner from you and the air conditioner is going to cost $750 because that's the going rate for air conditioners. In the event that I'm buying something that he had to bring from a distance, in the event that there are other investments that they have to make, they're entitled to calculate that within their cost, and the 1/6 is 1/6 over the sum of all costs involved. It's not only the physical product that we're talking about.
Sorry, 1/6 is the profit margin, or is 1/6 just like the $100 in your example already had the profit margin built in, and then you're going even over and above that?
Right. So that's a really good question that I'm not going to go into. It's a very good question. In other words, when we say 100, does that mean 100 was what it cost me to manufacture this thing? Or is 100 the going rate? That's the price that everybody charges, which already has built into it a certain acceptable level of profit. It's more sophisticated than I'm going to be able to do in this session. Maybe what I'll do, I like to send out a follow-up email afterwards, so maybe I'll include that in the follow-up question. The follow-up email, I should say. Okay. So, that's the basics of it. And on that basis, I would make the argument then, without knowing anything else, that Sarah is not able to charge people $7,000 unless she's going to go to the customer and say, the going rate is $5,000, I'm charging you $7,000. But short of that, she wouldn't be able to do it. However, there are two, what are called in Hebrew, heterim. There are two bases for allowing her to do this. And that's where things get interesting with contractors. The first one is one you discussed already last week, I think. And that's the question of, is there a standard rate in our modern economy? when there are so many prices that you can find, you know, you tell me the going rate is $5,000, right? I'm going to go to somebody who's going to say to me it's $4,500. Somebody else is going to say to me it's $5,200. We're accountants in the room. So, all right, it averages out, and the going rate is $5,000 if you calculate all the different quotes that you got. But that's not actually true, right? I can get different numbers from different people. There is a range of prices. There are other concerns as well, which go beyond the scope of what we're going to do. Prices fluctuate in different businesses. Not necessarily as much when you deal with contractors, but when you start dealing with products, certainly you have fluctuation as well. But the first question you have to ask is, does Ona'a apply if there isn't a known set price? In Roman society, you had a set price. Today, we don't. Bob, you were going to say?
No, you said something about like the seasonality. So the $7,000 driveway. Right now, it's high period. If you want it done today, it's $7,000. So it's really.
Yeah, it can even change over time. It can change. It can totally change based on the time of year. Agreed. If you take a look at source number 3, this is the basis for arguing that if you don't have a set price, there is no issue of ona'a. The Gemara, the Talmud in Bava Metzia, I'm going to use the English. I brought you the Hebrew so you'd have it, but I'm going to use the English in the interest of time. One who goes to milk his goats, shear his sheep, take honey from his hive. He's off to do something involving his living, essentially. His friend meets him and says to him, the first man says to the second one, whatever my goats produce is sold to you. I'm going to sell you whatever milk I get, or whatever wool I get from my sheep, whatever honey I get from my hive. So you're going to give me a sum of money without knowing what the quantity is that you're getting. The rule is, this is allowed. Now, in context, this passage in the Talmud is not talking about price concerns. It's talking about a completely separate discussion called rebate. Interest. You're not supposed to charge interest. That's a whole other discussion. But the concern here, theoretically, is this. I pay you based on what things are worth today. What you end up giving me may be worth more than what I paid you for. Right? I may end up getting a great deal. Well, it looks like I gave you cash, and you gave me back the value of my cash plus. That's interest. That's the fear. Right? Because there's a reason why you would do this deal. Let's put names on this deal, okay? I say to Chaim that I'm gonna shear my sheep. You want any wool? Chaim says yes. I'm gonna give you $100 for your wool. I may have $100 worth of wool, I may have $50 worth of wool, I may have $500 worth of wool. Why am I willing to take this deal from Chaim? Why am I willing to take $100?
You use the money.
Because I want the money up front. Right, I want the money now. I'm going to be able to use the money, and yeah, I may end up, you know, giving him $150 worth. But what that really means is that until he takes delivery of the wool, this is a loan. He has lent me $100, and he's going to get back potentially $150 worth of wool. So the Talmud is saying here that's okay, and the reason why it's okay, in brief, is because, first of all, this is being done in the manner of a sale. It's not being done with the wording of a loan, but more important, it's because he could lose. The idea of a loan with interest is that the lender is guaranteed that he's getting back at least what he lent out, and he's going to make money on it, assuming that the borrower doesn't default, which is its own discussion. In the normal course of business, the lender knows he's making money. In this discussion, he doesn't know he's making money. What he's really doing is he's investing. There's more to say about it, but the bottom line is this discussion isn't about pricing. This discussion is really a rebate discussion. However, the question comes up, why isn't this a problem of ona'a? Because he could end up paying me $100 for wool that isn't worth $100. The wool could be worth $50, and now I've overcharged him. So why isn't that a problem? So there are a few different answers, but the one that is of interest is from Rabbi Yosef Karo in source number 4, who asks the question regarding this passage in the Talmud in Maimonides' ruling, which confirms this statement in the Talmud. And his answer is, perhaps Maimonides, / the Talmud, only wrote this regarding something which has a set price, like wheat, but milk and wool have no set price. each person buys as he wishes, and there is no ona'a. In other words, what he says is, the case that you're seeing in source number 3 involved items for which there is no set price, and therefore the laws of ona'a do not apply. Based on that, we have the notion that ona'a will not apply to everything. Ona'a only applies if you have a set price. So the question then is, today, do we have set prices? So this was Rabbi Ziering's topic last week, correct? So you don't need me to reopen the can of worms, other than to tell you, surprise, it's a debate. There are multiple points of view, ranging from, on one end, Rabbi Asher Weiss, who says, no, there is no such thing, for the most part, with our set prices, to authorities who say there is, we just don't know exactly how to calculate it, to authorities who say to take the mean price or the median price, to authorities who seem to say, no, there is, absolutely, there is a set price, and you take the lowest going rate, or you figure it out somehow. There are different standards. But that's argument number one on behalf of Sarah's Paving Company. She could say, well, there is no set price. But where we get into new material is a completely different position, which may get the contractor out of trouble. In order to discuss this, we need to define two Hebrew terms. One is po'el, and the other is kablan. What is a po'el? A worker. And what is a kablan?
Contractor.
The po'el means somebody who works. That's somebody who does. And the kablan is someone who has accepted the terms of an agreement to provide something. That could be a service. That could be a product. But that's a contractor. And the rule is that when you deal with a po'el, with a worker, there is no law of ona'a. If you take a look at source number 5, Maimonides writes, one who hires a worker, a po'el, to work with his land or movables, is not subject to ona'a, no matter whether he's working with land, which is its own discussion, or movable items, no ona'a. Why? It is as though he purchases the worker for a period of time. In other words, the worker has essentially sold himself as a time-limited slave. I am a slave for this unit of time. And the rule is that ona'a does not apply regarding slaves. Now, that last point about ona'a not applying to slaves, I'm going to come back to. I'm not there yet. But Maimonides makes the statement, which is universal pretty much in Jewish law, that this worker is not going to be subject to the laws of ona'a. He has given you his own rationale by saying it's because this worker is like a slave. That's his addition, which we have to come back to. But ona'a does not apply to a po'el. So the question is going to be, what about for the contractor? What about for the kablan? You follow? You with me? Ona'a does not apply to workers. So there are three different explanations for why ona'a does not apply to a po'el, and you need to know the reasons in order to know whether it will apply to the contractor as well. The first one I bring you from the Ritva in source number 6. He's not the only one to discuss this. All his contemporaries brought this point of view. And their argument is, we conclude that there is ona'a when renting movables, because it is a temporary sale, but regarding accepting work and hiring a worker, it is obvious that there is no ona'a. Why? For the Torah says sale, and there is no sale here. Meaning, what he says is, the laws of ona'a are framed in the Torah, it's actually this coming week's Torah portion, with the word memkar, with the word sale. The chitim karumim kar la mitecha al tonu ish et achiv. When you sell something. So his argument, the argument of Ritva and others, is that there's no physical sale here. You hired somebody to do a job, to take care of your tax filing, whatever it is. Nothing has changed. No physical product has changed hands. Therefore, the laws of ona'a do not pertain.
He's not the product. He sold himself for a period of time.
So the way he's looking at it is that you're not. He doesn't agree with Maimon. He doesn't agree with the Rambam. He says you haven't sold anything. Nothing has changed hands. That's his view.
So you're not a slave.
You're not a slave, or so it appears. The second approach is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, also known as Rashbam, in source number 7. He said there's no concern for interest, but it applies to ona'a as well, regarding wages for labor. Why? workers hire themselves out for anything when they have no food to eat. And whatever he receives from the employer is profit. What he says is, there's no real set price because workers will take whatever they can get. If you tell me I'm only willing to hire you in the event that you will take this number of dollars per hour, and that's all I can get, then that's what I'm going to take. There is no such thing as a fixed price when it comes to a worker. So argues Rashbam in number 7.
Except minimum wage.
Well, minimum wage would be very interesting in its impact on this. Maybe you could argue for minimum wage, except that the worker is always going to go for more. The worker, if you tell the worker, I'm going to give you minimum wage plus 5, he'll say, great, that's what I'm going to take.
But minimum wage minus 5, you can't.
Correct. There's a floor, but there's no ceiling. So the argument would still be they'll take whatever they can get. It's not over zero. It's over whatever minimum wage in that jurisdiction will be. So that's a second argument. And then the third argument is indeed the argument that Maimonides, that the Rambam brought in number 5. He says a worker is acquired for the time of work. We discussed this way, way back. We had a class a few years ago on the topic of long-term contracts. Right? The question of whether one is allowed to sign a long-term contract. There is a prominent view in Jewish law that says that in the event that you are a worker who works specifically in the home of the employer, you're not allowed to sign an agreement to work for more than 3 years. And the reason is because 3 years is the standard definition for where things cross from employment into slavery. And the idea is that someone who signs a long-term agreement saying, I'm going to be with you until this period of time, is now accepting slavery upon themselves, and we don't like that. We don't approve of that. A Jew is supposed to be a servant of God and not of other human beings. Leave aside the question of slavery existing in the Torah anyway and how that works. It's a great discussion, but completely beyond the scope of what we can get to today. Slavery biblically was considered an economic safety net rather than a means of abusing people. But the point for us is that's what Maimonides says is going on with the worker. He says the rule is that ona'a does not apply with the purchase of an eved, of a slave, which is true. It's drawn from biblical text. So he says, since the po'el, the person who works by the hour, is like a slave, therefore the laws of ona'a will not apply for him either. So we have three different justifications. One, for why there is no ona'a when it comes to a standard worker, to a po'el. Number one, because there's no sale. Number two, workers take whatever price they can get. And number three, because he is like a slave. Well, now let's try to apply that over to a contractor. Going back to the first approach, going with the second approach first, the approach that they charge based on availability of work. So what would you say for the contractor? Does that apply? Yeah. Same thing is true for a contractor. Right? He'll take whatever he can get. She'll take whatever she can get. It doesn't make a difference. So therefore, there will be no ona'a for her either, according to Rashbam. And therefore, she can charge whatever she wants. And when I come and say, well, Sarah's paving company is doing something unfair, the answer is no. She's fine. She can do that. The second approach, which I had mentioned first, is that there's no physical purchase involved. So will that apply if you're dealing with a contractor? It'll depend, right? It depends on what they do. Did I hire somebody to file my taxes, right, for a service? Or did I hire somebody to make a table for me? If they're delivering hard goods at the end, then the argument will be ona'a should apply. It is memkar, right? I am purchasing this end product. Whereas in the event that I'm just paying for a service, then once again, I'm not truly buying anything. But now let's go to Maimonides, because this is the fascinating part. How do you classify workers and contractors within Jewish law? Right? In secular law, when you deal with with employee versus contractor, the standard is, are the parties one entity or two entities? If they are one entity, there's one business, and you're hiring somebody who's now working for the business, he's an employee, and the employer is responsible for certain elements of the employee's welfare, that's why the employer will pay into the retirement payments and so on. One entity versus two entities. If you want to discuss more about it, I was going to bring it on the source sheet, but ran out of room, but I gave you the links to the CRA and IRS policies on this in source number 8. You can see how they do it. But they do it based on issues like control. You know, who has control of what will be done and where it will be done and when it will be done, who provides the tools, who has the possibility of profits in the enterprise, right? A contractor is very different from the employee in that regard. However, when you get to the laws of Ona'a, our question is not, are they one business or two? Our question is the worker like a slave or not? Because that's the operative issue when it comes to Ona'a. Ona'a does not apply for slaves. Is this person like a slave or not like one? Well, how do you do that? How do you gauge that? So there are a few different ways to gauge it. The most popular approach is control of time. Because remember, what Jewish law in general allows the employee to leave whenever he or she wants. The general rule in Jewish law is the employee decides in the middle of the day, I've had enough, I want to go home, I'm forfeiting whatever I would have made the rest of the day. The answer is you can go. Possible penalties in the event that by leaving you will undo the work that you did earlier in the day, but otherwise you can leave whenever you like. That's the principal distinction between being an employee and being a slave. The slave says, I am not going to leave. For the period, for the term for which I have sold myself, I am here to the end. So it's about control of time. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein, writing in Austria in the 15th century, said, Maimonides wrote explicitly that hiring a person does not involve ona'a unless he is a kablan, a contractor. Then there is ona'a. And in the case that he is dealing with, the case that he is addressing, he says, ours is a case of hiring for a period of days, not a kablan. For he is assigned a period of days in which to complete their task. In other words, the employers came to the guy, said, we're hiring you, but you need to be done by this date. So he says, well, that, if you have to be done by a particular date, that makes you a poel, a worker, and not a contractor. Having a deadline, does that make sense to you? Having a deadline makes you an employee instead of being a contractor? No, that's very difficult. Everyone has deadlines. Why would I hire somebody without giving them a deadline, no matter what it is that they're doing for me? Well, that doesn't make any sense. He can say to me, I'll get back to you. You know, in 100 years, I'll get back to you. But pay me now. That doesn't make any sense. So that's a very difficult position. The more conventional approach is control of time means that you dictate you have to work on this at dedicated times. To say, you know, from 9 to 5, you have to be doing this. I hire a teacher and I say, you're going to teach at 11 a.m. and you're going to teach again at 3 p.m. That's something that makes somebody a poel. Whereas, in the event that I hire somebody and I say, you know, do me a favor, or not do me a favor, I'm going to pay you, but in the next couple of days, pave my driveway, and it's up to them to decide whether they show up Wednesday morning or whether they show up Thursday afternoon, even if I say to them, you have to be done by Friday, they're a contractor because they choose when they're going to do this work. Control of time is a key element of it. Yeah?
The three reasons that you have here, the overall overarching case, because the question is whether contractors are overcharging, whether they're basically stealing. The question is not whether people are robbing the contractors by underpaying them or something like that. But these questions about workers, it's not like the workers corresponding to the contractor, but here we're looking at whether there is anything wrong with underpaying them, at least that would seem to me.
So
a little bit of a difference in the way it's done.
Right. So let me mention a couple of things. Thank you. First of all, an important clarification, and I appreciate you asking the question. Ona'a applies not only if somebody charges more, but also if somebody pays less. So I go to the contractor and I say, I'm going to hire you to pave my driveway, and I'm only going to pay you $3,000. That's what I say to the contractor, and the going rate is $5,000. I'm just as guilty of ona'a and can be acted against. I just chose one because, number one, it's the more common. Generally speaking, with us, providers are the ones who set the price rather than the client. So it makes sense to frame it that way. Number two, it gets awkward to keep on saying overcharge or underpay. But that's number one. Number two, there's no theft in any of this. In other words, they set up front what their price is. There's deception in the sense that they're using your ignorance of the going rate in order to get away with it. But fundamentally, there's no theft involved. Okay. So the first distinction is control of time. Second distinction is control of task. So if you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Ephraim Navon, commenting on Maimonides, says... he says, even though he's commenting on Ritva in this case, it works for us in any case. He says, the distinction is between where somebody is hired for any job and where somebody is hired for a particular job. Meaning, in the event that I hire somebody for any job, I say, I am paying you to work for me today. I'm going to give you $100 to work for me today. What am I supposed to do? Whatever comes up, I may need you to mow the lawn, I may need you to deliver papers, I may need you to do whatever it is, $100 for the day. That is like a slave. Because the slave has no control of what he's doing, the boss can say, I'm going to have you do this, that, or the other thing. It's all determined by the boss, with the slave not having any input. As opposed to, you hire somebody for a particular job. This is what you're going to do for me in this period of time. I say, okay, thank you very much. That is less slave-like. So that's a second way to some frame it. A third way, more broadly, is that it's about the general relationship. Rabbi Yisr Zalman Meltzer, in source number 11, says it's really about the relationship. How do we view the payment? Is the payment for the work done? The specific task that was completed, or is the let me frame it differently. Sorry, better way to word this. Is he being paid for doing the work, or is he being paid for the result of the work? Is he being paid for the fact that he spent 20 hours building a cabinet, or am I buying a cabinet from him? In the event that I'm buying a cabinet from him, then he's a contractor. In the event that I'm paying him to work for 20 hours. Then it's actually an employee. Sorry? Then that person would be a poel. Yeah,
Shoshana. That would be number one. Going back to the story, no physical sale, hire someone to do a job,
yeah.
And there's no sale, that's where he said it depends on the service or hire the product.
Right.
Because you can hire someone to make you a cabinet for the work done, right. Not necessarily for the cabinet.
Right.
In which case, there.
Yes, all of these are ultimately merged in terms of how I look at them, and especially the third one. It's much more of a global feel for what's going on than a specific definition. Yeah?
The Eved, it seems to me, like a slave, has a lot of protections in the Torah.
Yes.
Does the poel have any of the protections, or just the downside?
Right. So the poel has protections, but they're protections that are meant to keep him from being a slave. So, for example, saying he can't have a long-term agreement, allowing him to leave middle of the day. Those are meant to avoid it. No, that will not, because you're not assigning him. He's doing it by choice. He was signed on. He signed an agreement to take this job. So you could hire him to do that.
But if you hire him for the day to do whatever work needs to be done in the company.
Right. He has the ability to walk away and say, well, I'm not doing that.
He does.
Yeah, he has the ability to quit. That's what the slave doesn't have. That's why what David is pointing out is that slaves have a protection in the Torah. You're not allowed to give them demeaning work. So that's true because the slave needs that protection because the slave doesn't have the ability to leave. The employee can walk away. So what we've seen, to make sure that we're clear on this, is that the contractor may not be subject to onah. Number one, if we say there's no price, going back to the issue from last week. And number two, even if there is a set price, the contractor may not be under onah, whether, according to Rashbam, because they're known to charge whatever they can get, or if they're not providing physical goods, or if their time slash tasks are controlled, and therefore they are like the po'el, like the eved, like the slave. That brings us to number two, part two. Two is much shorter than one, and three is shorter than two. So if you're looking at your watch, don't worry. We're going
to
be okay.
One thing I never understood, though, is how that applies, and the courts can just say it goes to the standard rate period, or it scales back to the 15%.
Good. So the answer is it depends on how bad the overcharge was. If the overcharge is at 1/6, then they can simply reverse the 1/6. The deal goes through, the regular amount is paid, and they give back the 16%. In the event, however, that the overcharge is actually beyond that, they can nullify the entire sale. They cancel the deal. And as a matter of fact, this is a very interesting point. It's beyond the scope, but it's an interesting point. Let's say that I hired somebody to do a job for me, and they overcharged me by 25%. I go to the court and I say, I want to claim ona'ah, but I want to keep the deal. I want to keep the product that they made. I want him to give me back the 25%. Can't do that. I can't do that. If I want the court to act, it means I'm open to dropping the entire deal. That's actually going to matter when we get to case number three, with the photography. So case number two is where there's no deception whatsoever. Sarah's Paving Company is right up front. They say $5,000 is the gun rate, and we are charging you $7,000. We're the only ones in the neighborhood. It's a busy time of year. This is what we're charging. Take it or leave it. So the question is, are they violating their good citizenship, so to speak? Oh, no, I will not apply, because I know exactly what they're charging and exactly what the difference is between the two. Keep in mind, in order to get out of ona'a, you have to say specifically what you are overcharging. Not just you should know this is more than the going rate. You have to actually explain how much over it is. There can be no ambiguity about it. So this brings us to a second category called hafka'at she'arim. Hafka'at she'arim literally is releasing of prices. And what it means is you're not allowed to essentially destroy the market rate by driving things up with overcharging. We talked about this a little bit in the fall when I gave the class on charging for medicine. So this came up a little bit there when I talked about what if somebody charges too much. But take a look at source number 13, which is the verse from which this is learned. If your brother becomes needy, it's also this week's Torah portion. If your brother becomes needy and his hand falls among you, meaning that he becomes indigent, you shall hold him, stranger or settler, and he shall live with you. The obligation is to help him live with you, and it continues to say, not take neshech or tarbit, those are forms of interest, usury. Revere your God, and your brother's life shall be with you. Those are the key words. V'chei achicha imach. The life of your brother shall be with you. You are responsible to keep him going, and that's what I'm talking about in terms of citizenship. So the Talmud speaks very strongly against those who manipulate the market to drive up prices. So if you take a look at source number 14, our sages taught hoarders of produce, usurious lenders, reducers of EIFA measures and releasers of prices. Reducing the EIFA measure means I'm going to charge you the same thing I always did for a volume. The EIFA is a volume. I'm just going to reduce the size of a volume. So EIFA is no longer what it used to be. That's no good. But the ones that are meant to catch our eye here are the hoarders of produce, right? That's a good way to drive up the price, right? Think OPEC over the years. Now they're in another mode of saying let's restrict production in order to help the price improve. And releasers of prices. It means somebody who is going to charge more and break the way that that pricing is working. This is not about deception at all. This is a completely different issue. Take a look at source number 15. Rabbi Menachem Meiri says it very clearly. One who sells must sell honestly and without ona'ah. If he declares his purchase price and intended profit, so then even should he profit more than 1/6, there would be no law of ona'ah as is explained. Still, the courts are obligated to set prices for all life necessities. So that's a key term. Life necessities. So we have a rule, which is brought in source number 16. One may not add to measures beyond 1/6 or to coins beyond 1/6. One may not profit more than 1/6. And this is talking about life necessities specifically. That's a key limitation. But before I get to that limitation of life necessities, key question. Is this only about people who are selling products? Is this only about a po'el? Will it apply to a contractor? So a funny thing happened along the way to discussing Hafka'at She'arim. I think Rabbi Ziering is probably going to discuss this next week because both of us have been very troubled by this week as we've been researching and preparing these classes. Ona'a is a much discussed topic in the literature of Jewish law. Pick a century, any century, pick a country, any country, and you will find a lot of discussion about ona'a, where it applies, where it doesn't apply, and so on. Hafka'at she'arim, the idea of not overcharging, almost nothing. Almost nothing in the records. The question is why? You know, what were people not asking the question of the rabbis? Were the rabbis answering the question without putting it in writing? You know, what was it that went on? And to me, the answer really may be people were not applying this, because whereas ona'a is a biblical law with some very clear aspects to it, Hafka'at She'arim is a rabbinic enactment meant to fulfill this biblical verse of look out for your brother. Look out for your brother. It's a very vague instruction. The rabbi said this means don't drive up prices. But if you look at the passages I just brought you on this from the Talmud and Bava Batra, there really isn't a lot of definition. You know, beyond this 1/6 mention, there really isn't a whole lot of definition to it. And so I suspect that what happened was, first of all, markets tend to correct, as we've said, and therefore someone who's charging more is simply not going to get business. But also, it was very, very hard to actually apply. You only start to see this quoted again in modern times. And you find a few responses, a few court decisions involving Hafka'at She'arim, involving this issue. So in trying to figure out, does this apply to contractors or not, I'm looking for responses down through the ages, someone applying it to contractors, I can't find anything, until you get to the 20th century. And here I started to find responsa dealing with it, and yes, they apply to contractors as well. So there was one case involving an architect.
You know, that's not surprising, I guess. It's typical of Gachari to want to do it behind the scenes, quietly. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, I think it just goes together. If you're trying to do some sort of manipulation of prices, or you have some understandings, or you know, monopoly, or oligopoly, you're always going to do it privately. So the rabbis had, people had no way, really, to address real situations. They really didn't know why things were really happening.
Right. That's gas in Toronto. It's all gas in Toronto until it goes on the radio.
Today it's a little different.
But it's true. The collusion and manipulating of markets will tend to go on behind the scenes, as opposed to just one merchant saying, I'm going to charge more than everybody else. Good luck. That tends not to be a winning business strategy. So it really could be that it was just the way it was being done didn't lend itself to that being addressed. Could be. But the one case that I saw involved an architect who charged a very high price for his plans. He said, it took me many days to prepare the plans that I'm now giving you, and he charges a min for it. And the fellow who has paid him for the plans thought it was going to be like a one-hour thing. He didn't realize what he was going to have to pay for. And he goes to the court and says, this fellow charging much more. That's Hafka'at She'arim. And in the course of the responsum, or the decision really of the court, the court wanted them to compromise. That's the court's decision on this, is you guys should figure this out. But the court does not say Hafka'at She'arim doesn't apply to contractors. That was not the court's answer. The court talks instead about a very interesting other aspect, which is the reason you went to this architect was because you wanted his reputation. You wanted his name on it, and since you wanted his name on it, you can charge whatever you want for your reputation. There is no set value for what it means to have this guy's name on it as opposed to somebody else's name on it, so he can charge whatever he wants. But they discuss it in that sense. They discuss it in terms of a mashgiach as well. The application of Hafka'at She'arim, if the mashgiach charges high prices because the person who is the producer of the food wants to have this person's name saying it's kosher. So once again, he can charge whatever he wants because it's for his name. You can charge whatever you want for your reputation. That's another application. The third application that I saw involved a shadchan. The shadchan, the middleman making the arrangement between the couple also. Is that Hafka'at She'arim? In all of the cases, Hafka'at She'arim can apply to contractors. It's not limited to people who are poalim, who are workers, and it's not limited to a product. It'll apply to a service as well. However, there are two limiting factors. Limiting factor number one is what I said before about life necessities. If you take a look at source number 17, it talks about not exporting certain things from Israel, which are chaye nefesh, life necessities. And the example is wine, oil, flour. So that's one limitation. So the claim that the paving company is overcharging me doesn't really work, because paving my driveway really isn't a life necessity. There's more to say about what constitutes life necessity, but I'll leave that for Baziri next week with real estate, because I know he wants to discuss that. So come back for the real estate discussion and the question of whether you can expand beyond food in defining life necessities. But the other reason for not applying it to the contractor or to the paving company is brought in source number 18. This is Rabbi Baruch Yitzhak Levine, and he's dealing in the case of the architect. And he says, regarding his claim that the architect did not need to invest days of work in preparing the plans, if he doesn't wish for the architect to do this, he has the choice of not using his services. Meaning, where there are many other ways that you could get the same job done, you can't make the argument that he is guilty of inflating the prices. Just go to somebody else. It is unclear to me how this fits, because isn't that always going to be the case? There isn't one person selling eggs in the city, one person selling wheat in the city. I have to admit being a little bit uncertain on this, but this is clearly his decision here, that the fact that there are others who could do this, who could provide the service, is what leads to not applying Hafka'at She'arim.
Yes. His argument to the Beis Din was, I thought it was going to take him X number of hours, and he's telling me it took him retrospectively,
yeah,
6 days or whatever to do it.
Right.
So I was under the impression, under one impression when I bought the service.
Right. So I think the distinction would be between a case in which there was actual deception. In other words, I told him this is a 3-hour job, and then it ended up being a 3-day job, in which case you're absolutely right. That's not even ona'ah, that's theft.
Right.
And a case, which is what we're talking about here, where you told him what the hourly rate is, he didn't ask any questions about how long it's going to take, and now he's angry.
Right.
I think that's the case that we're dealing with for the architect. Sorry?
No.
Yeah. So that's your principle in case number two. There is hafka'at she'arim for contractors. It does apply to people who provide goods, who provide services, but not if it isn't a necessity that's being purchased, and also not if there are other contractors who charge normal prices, which I assume there are. I'm still unclear on that second element, because I see the court use it in this ruling, but I don't understand, because that should really eliminate Hafka'at She'arim altogether.
You could have a service being provided that's quite unique.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a small oligopoly of people who have kind of all raised their prices at the same time, and you don't have a lot of other options, and there are no other options because it's patented or whatever, or it's unique or whatever.
Yeah.
But this architect is lots of architects.
Right. If so, though, it really is going to reduce the application of Hafka'at She'arim in each case.
Also, in that case, what's the likelihood that it would be a necessity? A life necessity.
Right.
If it's so...
Right. Life necessities tend to have more than one vendor. Unless you talk about, like, special medical care.
Well, it could be under license, or it could be something under government regulation, or, whatever.
Yeah, no, it is possible. Where it's something that requires high investment in order to develop it. Right. No, that's true.
Great things in today's modern day and age actually deal with ona'ah and...
Oh yes. Oh yes. The question of what their control is a good one. But I just gave you a couple of cases from Israel on Hafka'at She'arim. Realistically, it's only going to be an issue when both parties are interested in observing halal.
Of course, that's
But then yes.
But I'm just saying, assuming that party view.
Yeah.
Do you really actually see
yeah.
the cases?
Yeah. I mean, what you also see very interestingly is in Israel, the secular legal system honors the principles that are involved and designs laws with these values embedded in them. So in other words, there are secular laws in Israel about Hafka'at Sha'arim, which makes it very interesting when you're searching and trying to find articles on it in cases, because some of them are civil law cases. They're not Beit Din cases. I want to get to the third case, and we're getting to the end of the time. So just briefly, the photographer I mentioned in the beginning, the photographer took the pictures already. The wedding is done. Now you realize how the photographer is making the money by charging you a mint for the duplicates. So, what is your recourse? Generally, when we deal with ona'ah, we say that you have a period of time to back out. The period of time is called kedeshi arela tagar, meaning I bought a dress. The dress was $150. I show it to somebody who knows what they're doing, who says that shouldn't have been more than $100. I go make my claim. If enough time elapses that I could have shown it to somebody, and either I did, but for some reason waited to make my claim, or I didn't bother, then I have no further time to back out. That's it. So can I back out after the pictures are taken? So I saw a response, or an article really, on this by Rabbi Landman, who argues that if you hire somebody for a job which has a set price, that could have been clarified in advance of the employment, that was your opportunity to back out. It was beforehand. In other words, it's not like where there's a physical object where I couldn't show it to somebody until after I bought it. You hire somebody, you know what you're paying, go ask around. You chose not to ask around beforehand. That's your problem. Once you made the deal, you're in. You can't claim ona'ah anymore. I thought that was a very interesting argument. Unfortunately, I don't think he's correct. If you take a look at sources number 19 and 20, you'll see what I mean. The 19, Rabbi Moses Maimonides says, there is no ona'ah when renting tools or animals. For rental, there is ona'ah. For rental is a one-day sale. He says renting something also is under ona'ah. He must refund the ona'ah, and here are the key words, even after a long period of time. That's a very interesting turn of phrase. Why after a long period of time? We know what the time limit is. Says Rabbi Vidal of Toulouse, Magid Mishnah. He says, this is correct. For there is no set time, other than with a consumer who holds the object with him and displays it to a merchant or to his relative. Hiring people is not like that. The Talmud also did not mention a time period when hiring. He says no, not like what Rabbi Landman wanted to argue, that your time frame is until the deal. You have an infinite time frame. Because there was no physical object to display to a merchant, therefore you actually have a very long, unlimited as far as we can tell, period of time to back out. So I could back out when I'm hiring somebody for a service. I could back out for an extended period of time. Having said that, when it comes to the photographs, you're still going to be out of luck. And the reason why you're going to be out of luck goes back to what I had said answering Nathan before. The work is done. The product is there. In the event that you want to go to the court and back out, you're going to lose the photographs. You're out of luck, because there's only bitul mekach. You can only nullify the agreement. You can't just say, well, I just want a refund of the overpayment. So if you're willing to lose the photographs, go ahead. But realistically, that's not what happens, and therefore it's too late.
Can the courts reduce the price?
Nope. They cannot reduce the price. That's it.
That you underpaid. I mean, that's what you did out of greed, in the sense that you thought
you were getting a better deal. That's a very interesting argument. You could look at the case the opposite way, that you underpaid, unless you're going to say that the rate that he's charging includes, we look at it as a lump thing, it includes what he was going to charge for the duplicates, which you did agree to, you just don't end up buying duplicates.
Right.
So maybe that would be the way that we would look at it as a combined thing. That could be.
Totally.
Thank you very much. Again, next week Rabbi Ziering will be speaking about the Toronto real estate bubble. Thanks very much.